the views expressed on this program are those of the host and guests and are not necessarily those of IRN, its advertisers, or affiliates.
Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming at you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, of course, for this next hour, they're going to be the views of Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution, who has dedicated himself to trying to educate people about our form of government. You see, most Americans believe we're a democracy. Most Americans believe we have a two-party system, and whoever has the most votes can get things done. And that is exactly contrary to what this country was established to be. We were never to be a democracy. Our founding fathers feared democracy because they knew that people traditionally, down through the ages, had always voted themselves into dictatorship, always voting for the man who promises to give them the most in the way of benefits at somebody else's expense, and always ending up in dictatorship. In fact, if you read the Federalist Papers, and everybody should study the Federalist Papers, but if you read the 10th of the Federalist Papers, James Madison said that democracies are air spectacles of turbulence and contention, are air incompatible with personal liberty and private property, and are usually as short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. We were not to have a democracy. Now, we have a wonderful little pamphlet entitled, We Are a Republic, and we suggest you get it. It's really very inexpensive, and it will give you the information you need to know to be able to discuss this subject intelligently, because they do not teach the Constitution in our schools. They do not teach the Constitution in our colleges. They do not teach the Constitution in our law schools, because there are people who do not want you to understand the wonderful form of government that we have and how it has been perverted by an elite group who have a different agenda, who believe that an elite should rule the people, that if you can convince people we're a democracy and that the government can do whatever it wants to, all you need is majority rule. Why, of course, you will have exactly what we have today, and that is a nation that's on the brink of destruction, an immoral nation, a nation that's lost its path. And, well, if we're going to ever find the path, we've got to know what the path is. And that's why David Whitney is lecturing us, and he'll lecture us once a month on this station on the Constitution of the United States, the most amazing document that was ever written by men. Imperfect, because men are imperfect, but truly an amazing document that, of course, has given the American people more freedom than any other people have ever enjoyed for a longer period of time. But unfortunately, that freedom is in eclipse today. David, thank you so very much for being with us again.
It's a privilege, Dr. Stan, to be on your show, and you're absolutely right. To prove the points you've just made, you just need to look at the current election cycle here as the presidential campaign heats up, and they're talking about which candidate can outdo the other in promising more goodies to the American people, and they're all talking about, with one exception, Ron Paul. That is, the rest of them are all talking about, we're a democracy, we're a democracy, and you ought to get all the goodies you can, because we promise them, vote for me, and I'll give you more than the other guy. Every American should be aghast at what is being stated, because it's the opposite of what our founders actually designed our system of government to be. But because the Americans don't know what our founders designed, then they believe these liars and charlatans who are running for office and will vote for them, sad to say, come the first Tuesday in November.
Well, let me just point out that any government that can provide whatever you need must be able to take whatever you have, and whatever government that can provide for you from the cradle to the grave has got to be able to control you from the cradle to the grave. There is no free lunch, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to be free, you can't have a socialist government, and that's what we're working towards today. Well, David, go right ahead.
Well, the attitude of many patriots who really do understand the issues and really do understand what our founders designed our system of government as, a republic based upon the laws of nature, nature's God, a clear reference to God's word, the Bible, and the law of God established there, things like thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill. All of those laws are the intrinsic law of these United States, what was usually called the common law, based on English common law in those days. But if you understand these principles and you look at where we're at, many Americans who understand those things are despairing. They're wringing their hands saying, there's no hope, it's lost cause. Pack up and go home because there's nothing you can do. But that is a lie. That is not the truth at all. There is a great deal we can do to reclaim our constitutional republic. And so this evening I'd just like to share a victory plan for restoring our constitutional republic here in these United States. And it's the situation is not hopeless because the supreme law of the land is still the United States Constitution, and our form of government, our Declaration of Independence, clearly states that our form of government is based upon the laws of nature and nature's God. These things are still in effect. It has not been abolished. And although it is violated, it's violated because the American people do not know these principles and do not know what they need to know to hold their elected officials accountable. Unfortunately, many Americans have a false concept that you can just set our form of government on autopilot and walk to the back of the aircraft or whatever and make yourself a cup of coffee and relax and watch a movie and forget about what's going on up there in the cockpit. Well, that is not what our founders said. They said it had to take an active citizenry involved in what was going on and keeping a check upon the government so that the government, both on the state and federal level, would not become tyrannical. Well, the first thing that we need to do is to be sure our own faith is based upon the solid rock of the Lord Jesus Christ and His revealed word. We need to have a living relationship with Jesus Christ through faith in His finished work for us on the cross, and then we need to live a life as a disciple of Jesus Christ, a life of integrity consistent with that profession, such that our own self-government is taking place. You see, many people, when they hear the word government, they only think of one form of government, civil government. Well, Scripture and certainly our founders also understood there is self-government. Everyone's commanded to obey the law of God individually. There's family government. God has given responsibilities to families. And then there's church government.
Hold that thought, David. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. And, of course, it was John Adams who said that our form of government was made for a moral and religious people who would not work for any other. Our form of government was made for a moral and religious people who would not work for any other. Why? Well, because we had to have people who could govern themselves, who could take care of themselves, who could provide for themselves and for their friends and for other people in the community. But you had to have moral people. You either have to have moral people and you could limit government, or, of course, if you could destroy the morality of the nation, then you would have to have a dictator. You would have to have an authoritative body looking after the people to keep it from becoming chaotic. And we are increasingly becoming chaotic. Crime is rising. We have over 7 million Americans, over 2% of our population, in prison, probation, or parole. And that's the end result of the effort by the Supreme Court to destroy the moral foundation of this nation by taking God and prayer out of our schools, even taking the Ten Commandments out of our schoolhouses under the pretext that they wouldn't do any good unless the students read them. If the students read them, they might meditate upon them. If they meditated upon them, they might obey them. And if they were to obey the Ten Commandments, that would be a direct violation of the law of separation of church and state. And yet, of course, the Supreme Court opens their session every day with the choir comes in and says, God save the United States in this honorable court. Why is it all right to mention God before the Supreme Court, but not in our schools? That you wanted to destroy the moral foundation of our country. And as Pastor Whitney has said, we have to have moral people or we cannot be free, for, as William Penn had said so well, those who will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants. And since we're not ruled by God, why, of course, they're moving towards a police state in America. That's, but you go right ahead, David.
Yes, and what we need then is true Christians who are willing to be followers of Jesus Christ no matter what the cost. And because the basic building block of a nation are the individuals of solid character who really are self-disciplined, and then the families that they build and the churches that they build up. That these are the essential building blocks. When you get to the level of civil government, if you don't have those solid building blocks below it, the civil government cannot function as a republic. As you stated, it can function as a dictatorship because the tyranny works pretty well if you have absolute power and you strip the people of any ability to defend themselves and you strip them of any wealth and all those things. Then you can rule as a tyrant and prevent anyone from getting out of hand. But a nation where freedom is enjoyed, that is, true liberty is not the license to do whatever you choose, including to do evil, wicked things. No, liberty, and this is what our founders clearly said as well, liberty is the ability and the freedom to obey God's law. That is, personally, to walk in obedience to the principles laid out in God's Word. So we need righteous Christian citizens and churches that are reaching out to the lost, those who do not know Jesus Christ, leading them to faith in Christ, and then making disciples of them so their self-government is in tune with God's Word, their family government and church government are all in tune with God's Word. I think, yes, it was General Douglas MacArthur who said, history fails to record a single precedent in which nations subject to moral decay have not passed into political and economic decline. There has been either a spiritual awakening to overcome the moral lapse or a progressive deterioration leading to ultimate national disaster. And he's absolutely right. We've got one of two directions to go as a nation. Disaster, which is to continue on the course we are on currently, or a revival, that is a return to true Christian faith and obedience to God's law. There's no in-between. There's no, well, maybe we'll go halfway. No, we're either going down or going up. And so a personal revival on the part of individuals and families and churches that would sweep the nation is what I'm praying for, and I know many others are praying for around the country, recognizing that this is essential. But we must not stop there. If we just brought about a personal revival, and perhaps this has been some of the weaknesses of the revivals that have taken place in America, that they didn't go beyond that. It's like, well, I'm going to get my own house in order, my own individual life, my own church, and my own family, but that has nothing to do, and I have nothing to do as a Christian with politically what's happening, or what's happening in the civil government. We must understand that as Christian citizens, in this constitutional republic, we have a clear calling that to be obedient to Christ's command, to render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, involves our active participation here in this constitutional republic. That is, when Jesus said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, he was talking far more about than just taxes. He was talking in the system of government you are in, you are to render all that they are due. For example, serving on jury duty. I know most Americans, when they receive a summons for jury duty, say, oh, no, I don't. How can I get out of this? Rather than saying, no, this is a great privilege I have of rendering and seeing that justice is done in our society. So voting and serving on jury duty, being involved with our legislators, and let's talk about what it will take to restore our constitutional republic. It will take a base of citizens, millions of Americans, who understand the constitutional principles of government and who refuse to elect anyone to public office who does not respect and promise to abide by those principles. In other words, if we don't have a standard to measure politicians by, we are going to have tyrannical politicians. And they love that, which is why they don't teach the Constitution any longer in public schools, and they don't read the Declaration of Independence. They avoid those altogether because they know if they taught those things in school, then they would be raising up a whole army of citizens who would oppose tyranny and oppose politicians who are literally breaking the law, the supreme law of the land. 90%+ of the things they do in Washington, D.C. are completely unconstitutional.
And, of course, they never could have been done 75 years ago, because in those days people understood the Constitution. They understood you have to limit what they do in Washington, D.C. But little by little, step by step, the people of great wealth began to transform America, because, after all, how could they rule if they didn't centralize all power in Washington, D.C.? And step by step, they've done that. Till today, of course, you have the government run by politicians who are bought and paid for by people of great wealth. Who's putting up all the millions of dollars, well over $100 million for both Obama and for Hillary Clinton? Why, it's the big corporations. Well, you and I can only give $1,000 or $2,000, and yet Lehman Brothers can give each candidate $100,000, $200,000, and the big banks can give them hundreds of thousands of dollars. How can they get away with it, and we can't give larger sums of money? Why, very simply, we have different set of standards for the elite and for the common people. They don't want the politicians answerable to the common people. They want them answerable to the people of great wealth. And if you don't believe that's happening, just ask yourself, how can these people, these corporations, banks, give hundreds of thousands of dollars where you and I are limited to giving $2,000? How does that happen? Well, of course, because the politicians write the laws. That's how it is. And of course, they don't want the common people influencing the elections. They want it done by the big money. And that's, of course, we have one candidate who's raised millions of dollars, but from the little people, not from the big people. He doesn't get any $300,000 or $400,000 contributions from the banks. That's because he stands for the Constitution. Go right ahead, David.
Well, many people would say, well, David, that sounds very nice, but that's not practical, and that can't happen. There was, however, a time in America where that was exactly the case, where Americans really did understand the Constitution, and they could speak intelligently about it. Alexis de Tocqueville, a Frenchman, in 1835, came to America basically to study our penal system and see what the prisons were like and so on. And he had a fascinating tour here in America, discovering what he was very surprised to see. What he discovered, very stark contrast with his own country, and he wrote, after noting Americans' ignorance about European affairs, he said, "But if you question the average American respecting his own country, the cloud that dimmed his intelligence will immediately disperse. His language will become as clear and precise as his thoughts. He will inform you what his rights are and by what means he exercises them. He will be able to point out customs which obtain the political world. You will find that he is well acquainted with the rules of administration, that he is familiar with the mechanisms of the law, of the laws. The citizen of the United States does not acquire his practical science and his positive notions from books. The instruction he has acquired may have prepared him for receiving those ideas, but it did not furnish them. The American learns to know the laws by participating in the act of legislation, and he takes a lesson in the forms of government from governing. The great work of society is ever going on before his eyes and, as it were, under his hand." So that was a day where a foreigner walked into our country and was astonished to see how very intelligent and informed the American citizen was about his civil government, and how involved he was in speaking to his legislators, in holding them accountable to the standard of the Constitution. And as a Frenchman, it was quite a contrast with his own country. And just contrast that with the survey done, this is 20 years ago, so it might even be far less statistically than it was at that time. But a study done revealed vast constitutional ignorance. 46% did not know that the purpose of the Constitution was to create a federal government and to define its powers. 26% believed the purpose was to declare independence. Got the Constitution and the Declaration confused. 59% did not know the Bill of Rights is the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, and 27% of those surveyed thought the Bill of Rights is the preamble to the Constitution, completely confusing the matter. And we need educated citizens who know what the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration say, understand the biblical principles of law and government, and willing to teach other people, or I should say, communicate these truths to other people, to raise up this vast body of citizens that we need in order to retake our constitutional republic and restore its greatness.
And I think the important thing for people to understand is that the purpose of the Constitution was to limit the power of the federal government so we could have a republic, and so the federal government could not do all the things for us. Matters having to do with life and liberty and property were to be matters to the state and the local level. But the purpose of the federal government was limited strongly by the change of the Constitution. Isn't it a shame we've forgotten? Go right ahead, David.
And part of the loss is on the individual level, learning and sharing these and disseminating these truths across the country. But another level is the churches. The churches of our land used to be, and De Tocqueville said he understood America's greatness only when he went into the churches of America and he heard the pulpits flame with righteousness. That is, he heard the proclamation of God's law, how it applies in society, and when society was not following God's law, a clear rebuke was being issued. And churches today have gotten far too comfortable with the way things are, far too unwilling to be prophetically vocal about errors and sin that is being committed on the part of the civil government, far too comfortable not to call the civil government into account for violating the standards. And when you look at the Bible, there's ample material that deals with law and government and what's a just government. The biblical principles of law and government are clearly taught from one end of the scripture to the other. And when you look back at the history of our country, we would never have come into existence. We never would have separated from Great Britain at all had it not been for the colonial preachers who used to preach the biblical principles of law and government to the people of God. And they knew they had a prophetic calling as pastors to criticize the king when the king stepped out of line and violated God's law. And they used to preach election sermons. About this time of year, they would be telling the people, here's what the kind of candidate you must vote for, and here's the kind of candidate you must not vote for. They preached this to their people. And of course, after the election was held, every state, traditionally, the governor of the state would call together the elected officials and call in a preacher to preach to the elected officials what God's word told them they must do. The church was very powerful because it told the people God's law regarding who they must elect, and then it told those once they were elected what God's law said about the job they must do. So the church was a prophetic ministry that would call the civil government to account when the civil government stepped out of line. And this is a very biblical pattern. You look at the Old Testament, all the prophets preached to the kings. You know, Nathan rebuked David and said, you committed adultery, you committed murder. These are sins, heinous sins against Almighty God. And Elijah preached to Ahab. And come into the New Testament, what do you have? You have John the Baptist preaching to Herod, saying it's against the law for you to have your brother's wife. And Herod got a little upset because he said, wait a minute, I am the law. I'm the king. I'm the law. I determine what's right and wrong. John said, no. God's law says this. You have violated God's law. And it cost John the Baptist his head. Why were all the disciples of Jesus Christ persecuted and all of them but one martyred for their faith? Well, because they preached clearly the application of God's law, and when civil government disobeyed God's law, they were not shy at all to proclaim that disobedience was a violation of the supreme law of the universe, God's law. And we need to see churches restoring this role that they played in society that once made America great, as de Tocqueville said, and as our own history demonstrates. One way every church across the country could do that is to host an institute on the Constitution there in their church. We put together a package that makes it easy for any group of people to teach these principles, putting in the lectures of constitutional professor John Eidsmo, 12 lectures and 2 lectures by David Barton. It's very simple for anyone to do this. And I encourage people across the country, if they want to talk to their pastor, and their pastor's a little reluctant.
Hold that thought there, right, David? We'll be back in just a minute. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney. We're talking about the Constitution. David was just commenting that, you know, back in colonial days, why the ministers would get up and they would tell the parishioners who they should be voting for, the sort of man they should be voting for, would criticize the candidates if they were immoral individuals. Well, you can't do that today. Because, of course, very subtly, what they've done is most of our churches are agencies of the state. They all are under federal control. Why? Well, because they've become corporations. They no longer then have the protections of the First Amendment that says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And once you become a corporation, you are no longer a church. You are an extension of the state, and that's why most ministers are afraid to speak out. And when they do, the IRS is right there. Why? Because they don't want the people to understand how corrupt their politicians are. They don't want righteous men criticizing unrighteous men. And the ministers, tragically our churches all across America, have taken the financial advantages of becoming corporations and having, of course, their tax-exempt donations to get more money that way. These people have far more desire to make money than they do of serving God, unfortunately. And most ministers, of course, justify it. Well, but if we didn't have that tax exemption, why people would have to pay taxes on the money that they give. Well, we are not a tax-exempt organization, a ministry. We gave up our tax exemption so we could speak the truth. Unfortunately, all across America, we have ministers who are afraid to speak the truth because they don't want a visit from the IRS. Go ahead, David.
And we'll talk about that maybe in a succeeding month as to how they can get out of that and what Christians should do about that whole set of issues, because that is a very important issue. But we are encouraged here at Institute on the Constitution, as we've encountered many churches who are willing to conduct and host a class. And as I was saying before the break, that if people find resistance on the part of their pastor to holding this kind of class, or maybe the pastor doesn't need to lead it, really any layperson can host this class. If there's some resistance, I always encourage them, have your pastor call me. As a pastor talking to a pastor, I will explain from God's Word why this is not just optional. This is what every church should do that wants to really make disciples. That is, to do what Jesus said the church is supposed to do, go into all the world and make disciples. A disciple is one who obeys everything Jesus commanded, including his command to render to Caesar that which belongs to Caesar, which in our form of government means you have to know the Constitution, Bill of Rights, Declaration, and you have to be an actively involved citizen. Otherwise, you're not obeying Jesus' command to render to Caesar. So churches can host Institute on the Constitution, and this is a good way in which we can spread the message across the country and raise this base of citizens that's needed to restore the Republic. Some of the other areas we need to see that we affect with the constitutional view of law and government is judges and lawyers, law students. They need to understand these constitutional principles. If we have friends that are in any of those fields or even thinking of going to those fields, we need to encourage them to take the class Institute on the Constitution, learn what our founders truly said, because most, that 99%+ of the law schools that they would attend or have attended, will not teach them. They will not teach them what the Constitution actually meant by what the founders said. They'll teach them instead all the ways it's been twisted, undermined, subverted, and downright stamped upon by the courts of our land, especially in the past 100 years. So we need to encourage people who are in those fields to learn and to study the truth for themselves. I often ask attorneys when I meet them for the first time, in law school, how did you study the Constitution? Have you actually read through and studied clause by clause, phrase by phrase, what the founders meant by, almost to the person. Thus far have not met one who said, oh yes, we did it that way. No, they always said we studied case law, what the judges said the Constitution meant, not what the Constitution meant according to those who drafted it and according to those who ratified it. And so we need to be involved in that level. We need to find candidates that we can support, candidates who truly do hold to these views, which is, again, why we need to study and understand these and be able to sift through the candidates both on the federal and state level to discover, are there constitutional candidates that we can support and encourage, be part of their campaign in whatever way it's possible, to see them take a firm stand for restoring the Constitution, restoring our constitutional republic.
Well, I agree with you totally. I think it's vitally important that people people really understand the foundation of our freedom? Because if you don't understand, how can you possibly speak out against the corruption in Washington, D.C. today? And next time you hear somebody say we're a democracy, ask where in the Bill of Rights or the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence or the Federalist Papers, does it say we're a democracy? That's what tyrants want. After all, wasn't Adolf Hitler democratically voted into office? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest is Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution, who is doing a wonderful job of helping people to understand the foundations of our freedom. Go right ahead, David.
Well, some of the things that we need to advocate for, that is, when we speak to our senators or congressmen, when we talk to candidates who are running for office, when we talk to attorneys or judges, we need to advocate for three specific things. Original intent is the first. That is, the Constitution should be interpreted as it was written. Because when you have any contract, that contract has to be interpreted as it was written, not as somebody else thought it should, what it should mean, but as it was written. You have a will. What's the determination of what that will mean? It's the one who wrote that will. The person who's dead. Now, of course, because he's dead, you can't ask him exactly what he meant, but you can tell from what he said what the original intent of that will is. And likewise, with our founders, we not only have the Constitution, you've also, you mentioned earlier, the Federalist Papers. They give us an explanation of many aspects of the Constitution, what they meant by the words they put on paper in our Constitution, Declaration, and Bill of Rights can be understood. We can get back to the original intent. And this is what we should oppose. Any change of the Constitution's meaning at all. If you want to change the way the Constitution functions, then you need to amend it as Article 5 provides the means for amending it. So original intent, and that is in contrast and in opposition to the living Constitution. By the way, that living Constitution is really a propagandistic phrase. Nobody wants a living contract that changes at the whim of one party to the contract. No. You want a fixed contract. It's going to stay the same today, tomorrow, because you agreed to certain elements. And if there's any change to that contract, you must be consulted and you must agree to any changes in that contract. Whether it's with your auto mechanic when you go in to get an oil change, you agree to the contract. And if he does something different, like change your engine, you say, no, I'm not going to pay for that. I did not agree to this change in the contract. So it is with our Constitution. We do not want it to change except by the means we have agreed by which it can be changed. That's the amendment process. And the second thing here is strict construction. That is to give the Constitution narrow meaning versus loose construction to give it a broad meaning. And this is important because if you give it a broad meaning, you can read all kinds of things in there that were never in the intention of the original framers. The biggest one is the welfare, general welfare clause. We've talked about this before, but the idea that Congress cannot tax and raise money.
Hold that thought, David. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is David Whitney, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. Before we go on, David, I want you to give out your telephone number, or your website, so people can get in touch with the Institute of the Constitution and begin to learn about this wonderful form of government we have. A message that has long since been forgotten because there are people who don't want the American people to know the difference between a republic and a democracy. And, of course, then step by step, under the guise that we really are a democracy, to centralize all power with Washington, D.C., which is the path to dictatorship. So let's go ahead and let's get your information out, David.
Yes, as I shared earlier, we have what we call a host kit, a way that anyone can really communicate these principles with the 12 lectures by Professor John Eidsmo and 2 lectures by David Barton and a student notebook and a host manual that gives the host all the instructions as to how to conduct a class. And people can purchase that either by online means, that is going to our website and using the web store there. Our website at Institute on the Constitution is iotconline.com. That's all one word, iotconline, HostKit.com. And actually on the first page there, you'll see click if you want a host kit, and that'll take you to the web store. And there's many other resources available, books and DVDs and CDs that are available for purchase that can help you become an educated citizen and understand the issues that we face today. If you don't have web access, or if you prefer to use a telephone to purchase that, we're on the East Coast, of course, so our office hours there will be adjusted for anybody calling from the West Coast. But our toll-free number at Institute on the Constitution is 866-730-9796. That toll-free number for Institute on the Constitution is 866-730-9796. We're encouraged, as all across the country, people are conducting classes, and we hear of places where classes are multiplying. That is, once a person graduates having taken the class, many of those people are going on to host classes in their own churches or their own communities, and we see that kind of multiplication process taking place, which is very encouraging in this day. Before the break, we were mentioning strict construction, giving the Constitution the narrow meaning, because if you broaden the meaning, like with general welfare, saying, well, it can mean anything, or it can mean something opposite of what it actually states, specific welfare for a specific group of people, rather than, no, everyone must benefit at this general welfare. You can't say people 65 and older benefit with this. No, you can't spend any money, you can't tax anybody for something that's going to only benefit a specific segment of the citizens of our land. The strict construction is something we need to call for and to urge. And then the third thing is judicial restraint. Courts must only render decisions regarding how the law applies in the particular case that is before them, like Roe v. Wade. Really, Roe v. Wade did not change the law of America. It rendered an opinion, and by the way, that's all judges do. They render opinions regarding this one case between Roe and Wade. That's all. And judicial restraint would say that policymaking cannot be conducted at all by the court. That's to be left to the legislature. That's what the legislature is there for, to make law or to render law that is in accordance with the laws of nature and nature's God. The opposite of judicial restraint is what we see widespread today. Judicial activism. You know, judges actively striking down statutes, policies, actively establishing policies by their own standard rather than following the standard of the Constitution. In a sense, as some have said, that, well, the Supreme Court's the continuing constitutional convention. Where in the Constitution do they have such a power granted to them? Nowhere. So if they're acting like a continuing constitutional convention, they are usurpers. They are violating the supreme law of the land. They need to be impeached, if that's what they're doing. So the strict construction and original intent and judicial restraint, these three really go hand in hand. And if we can encourage people as citizens to understand these three things and demand them of their legislators, we will be a long way down the road to restoring our constitutional republic. Now, the reasons we mentioned earlier for original intent is every field of law other than constitutional law calls for original intent. How do you interpret a statute passed by a legislature? Well, what was the intent of the legislature? How do you interpret contracts? What was the intent of those who made the contract? How do you interpret wills? And on that goes. And furthermore, our framers believed in absolute truth that is based on God's word, God's law, and therefore original intent would be the guiding principle. No relativism, that things change over time just because you like change or something. No, it's the original intent governs what should happen. Furthermore, we have millions of Americans who have taken an oath to uphold the Constitution, either when they enter the armed forces or any other public office, and I like to talk to people who've taken that oath, and talking with somebody around Christmas who, as a military individual, had taken that oath, and I asked them what training they had received about the Constitution. They said, none. I asked them, well, then you were taking an oath to uphold something you didn't know anything about. They kind of looked sheepish and said, well, yeah. So I invited them to a class on the Institute on the Constitution to be able to learn what it is they'd made a promise to do. And again, we can reach many people this way that already have made that kind of oath and need to know how they go about fulfilling that oath. And when we move forward as citizens to do this, we can win the hearts of millions of Americans as they recognize, as many people do in this current campaign, that, you know, we're not going to get anything but all of the same with whoever gets elected other than Ron Paul, because these people are all for big government. These people are all for taking more money out of our pockets and reducing our freedom as well as our wealth on the way to moving us into the New World Order, North American Union, all those things. They're all for it. All of them are moving that same direction. It's, you know, twiddly-dee, twiddly-dum. It's not going to make a dime's worth of difference who gets into office unless it was Ron Paul. So when we see this, we need to remember that our founders warned us not to fall into this trap. Thomas Jefferson in 1823 said, on every question of construction, let us carry ourselves back to the time when the Constitution was adopted. Recollect the spirit manifested in the debates, and instead of trying what meaning may be squeezed out of the text or invented against it, conform to the probable one in which it was passed. That was the standard. Go back to the original intent, the meaning of those who actually ratified, those who actually wrote the words on paper. So we need to work for people who will hold these principles. We need to work to see that they're elected to office, and we need to work also on the opposite side of this to resist the growth of what's called administrative law. This is government agents, bureaucrats, who are unelected, therefore they're unaccountable to the people, making their own regulations, which in practice really become laws. I mean, the IRS is full of this kind of bureaucratic decisions that have no answer to the people, that become what's called administrative laws. And that's completely a violation of our structure of government. To have an unelected person, unaccountable to the people, making law is tyranny, really. Because we, the people, have no say in what's taking place, just as they said in the Declaration of Independence. You know, we have taxation without representation. Well, they were basically also saying we cannot have legislation without representation. So the entire thing of administrative law needs to be cut back and, you know, basically abolished, because it's unconstitutional. We need to cut down the size of government. And here, most Americans are for the idea until they realize, oh, yeah, maybe this is going to have an impact on my own pocketbook. Maybe, you know, I've got this student loan from the government for going to college, or all of these things need to be done away with, because they are unconstitutional, even if it affects us and even if it makes a negative impact on our own life. For the sake of freedom, for the sake of preservation of our constitutional republic and the return to it and restoration of it, we need to sacrifice even those things that we would benefit from.
Because I think that really every group out there is getting bribed by the government. Mm-hmm. As you point out, the students are getting bribed by the government. The educational establishment is getting bribed by the government. The government's providing money for them. The farmers, traditionally very conservative, but they get subsidies for the government under one guise or another. The doctors, oh my goodness, when I was in organized medicine, the doctors were always trying to figure some way that they get the government to pay more money for Medicare or for Medicaid or something else. Everybody wants money for themselves, and what people don't understand is once you become dependent upon the government, then you're simply haggling over the price. They used to say that about prostitution, and that's really what it is, because once you come under government control, then you only haggle over how much you're going to be able to get in return for giving up your freedom. People must understand that according to our Constitution, there is no justification for government to be paying doctors or providing loans for students or subsidizing the farmers or subsidizing education. All power is not specifically given in the Constitution to the Congress or to be limited to the states and the people. How we've forgotten all of these things because we all want to get our share of the booty. And of course, unfortunately, with that comes the price of your freedom and eventually enslavement. And this is exactly what's happening today. You can't have a government that provides for you from the cradle to the grave without having a government that controls you from the cradle to the grave. Never forget that. Go ahead, David.
And, you know, what the principle you're talking about, it was well written up by in the book The Law by Bastiat, a Frenchman, about 1850. Actually, we include that in our student notebook, as the whole book is there as part of our student notebook in the host kit, because we think it's very important for people to understand the principle he calls legalized plunder. That is, I cannot steal from your pocket and take it and put it in my pocket. That's theft. We recognize that as theft. Neither can I hire a criminal to do the same. So if I hire this criminal to steal the money out of your pocket and give me a cut of the money he stole out of your pocket, that's criminal as well. Neither can I hire government to do that which is illegitimate for the government to do, take money out of somebody else's pocket and put it into my pocket.
But they do that all the time here in the United States,
yes.
And we go right along with it because we hope we're going to get a larger share.
And we need to recognize that theft is against God's law. And furthermore, the government is always an extremely inefficient way to redistribute wealth, even if that were your goal, which is an illegitimate goal, because government bureaucracy sucks up most of the money before it ever gets to the supposed people that it's going to meet the need. So 60% goes to bureaucracy and maybe 40% actually goes to the thing that it was supposed to help. It's an extremely inefficient way. Actually, thieves are a far more efficient way to redistribute wealth than that. But the whole thing is unconstitutional. The whole thing is ungodly. It's a violation of God's law. It's not what God has given government the jurisdiction to do. And we need to call for government to get back within the bounds that God clearly establishes. Some of that can be done where states, if the a state will interpose itself between the people of the state and the federal government, one of the things that could be done on every state is what's called a Tenth Amendment resolution. You recall the Tenth Amendment basically says any powers not clearly delegated to the federal government belong to the state or to the individuals. Well, if a state would declare a Tenth Amendment resolution that says any federal mandates which lack specific constitutional authority will be considered invalid in this state of Maryland or whatever state, and therefore we will not act upon them because they are a violation of the contract that we the people have entered with informing our federal government. So if the states were to begin acting on this, and by the way, state legislators, even liberal ones, would be allies on this issue because most of them do not like the federal encroachment upon their authority in their own state, which is usually what happens because money always transfers to strings attached. So if money is going to come back to the state, it's going to come back with all sorts of strings attached where the federal government is increasing their authority, encroaching upon the authority of the state. Tenth Amendment resolutions in each state that enacted and begun to be utilized by that state to push back the size of the federal government would be a very, very effective way to see this done. Furthermore, there's several amendments that would be good to consider for our Constitution, particularly one that would prevent the ongoing misinterpretation of our Constitution. The amendment declared the Constitution must and shall be interpreted strictly according to the framers' intent would do away with a lot of the garbage, a lot of the legislation that's already in place that is unconstitutional. Say it cannot continue because it's not according to the strict construction of the Constitution. That we could have an amendment that would specifically define the General Welfare Clause shall not include the power to tax and spend for any specific welfare of individuals or groups. In other words, preventing the misinterpretation of the General Welfare Clause would be a valuable amendment to our Constitution. Furthermore, the phrase interstate commerce, and that's been much abused, and an amendment that would define that, restricting it strictly to the meaning of our founders, not allowing it to bleed over as it does today into intrastate commerce, that is, trade within the state itself, not between the states.
But of course, the founding fathers understood all of these things, and what they have done is simply misinterpret the meaning of the words because they wanted to centralize all power with Washington, D.C., and until people understand there really are people who want a dictatorship in America, who want, video cameras on every corner and in every home and in every, who would actually want to be able to track the activities of every individual in this country, until people understand there are people with a different worldview, because they believe that an aristocracy has the right to rule, and you common people should just do what you're told to do. Until people understand that there really are wicked people of great wealth and great power who work with specific organizations and are intent upon destroying the freedom that once made America the envy of the world, then, of course, nothing is going to change. It's so important that people understand the Constitution, the original intent, and the fact that there really are people out there who know exactly what they're doing. And they place people in the Supreme Court year after year after year who don't believe in the Constitution, who will play word games, but always intent upon centralizing all power with the central authority, where it was never to lie. Go ahead, David.
And in terms of reining in the judiciary, there's many things that can be done. One is to call for impeachment, and even if impeachment doesn't succeed, if judges are threatened with impeachment, that may cause them to think twice about acting unconstitutionally in their behavior. Another aspect of that is Article 3, Section 2 provides for the Congress to limit the jurisdiction of the federal court in many matters. They could stop abortion today by restricting it and saying, no, the federal government, the federal judiciary cannot rule regarding abortion. It's the issue that belongs back in the states.
And I agree with that. Let's get your website off one more time, David, and your telephone number.
IOTCOnline.com, and our phone number is 866-730-9796.
That's IOTCOnline.com. Go right ahead, David. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Stan. It's always such a blessing to speak with your listeners, because I know that it reaches a wide circle of people, and this is what we need, people who will take action. The first and easiest action for them to take is to get a host kit and begin to study the materials themselves with perhaps their family, gather a group of people at church, and then go beyond that. Gather people into the in your community, particularly as we're in election year. People are, you know, scratching their head about different aspects they're hearing about in the debates. We can make a difference, and this is a prime time to do it, and we need to act. We need not to be passively letting our Constitution and our country be destroyed by these who have a plan for a new world order, for stepping the North American Union. We need to stop it, and we need to take action ourselves, and the action that everybody can take is getting a host kit and conducting a class and beginning to expand the number of people in your community that understand these things, and then working for candidates who will uphold these and demanding of our elected officials that they restrict their behavior, restrict their legislation to that which they are permitted to do under the Constitution. Particularly, we need to know Article 1, Section 8. Any law that goes outside the boundaries of Article 1, Section 8, the only powers Congress has to tax and spend are listed there, 18 specific things they can do. Nothing else are they permitted to tax and spend for. And if we were to draw our government back to that list of Article 1, Section 8, we would reduce the size of government, we would reduce the tax bite of government on the average citizen, and in an enormous sense. So we need to get involved, and we need to not let our constitutional rights atrophy for lack of exercising them. And most of all, most important of all, is what Paul told us in 1 Timothy 2. He said, first of all, prayer be made for all in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence. We need to pray for our country. We need to pray for our constitutional republic to be restored. We need to pray for our leaders to repent. Many of them have violated their oath of office in an egregious sense, and they've imperiled their eternal soul by taking an oath that they never intended to fulfill, and having violated that oath, they're going to answer one day on Judgment Day. And as citizens, we can warn them. The oath that you took is before Almighty God, not before the people, and one day, God is going to hold you accountable. Here's what you need to know about your oath, and here's the standard, Article 1, Section 8 kind of stuff, and you're violating it in this way, and I am calling or writing to you because I care about your eternal soul. So we need to be a witness to these people. We need to pray for them. Most of all, we need to take action so that we would fulfill our calling as Christian citizens, that we fulfill what Jesus Christ has commanded us.
We're out of time, David. Good night. God bless.
God bless you. Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we hope that you enjoyed our conversation with Pastor Whitney. we have him on every month, first of all, because the Institute of the Constitution supports us, and because we support the Institute in their effort to, of course, reacquaint the people of this country with the most amazing document that men have ever written. But it was really based upon the Declaration of Independence, which held that we were given certain rights by our Creator, and the government was instituted among men to secure our God-given rights. That's what it says in the Declaration of Independence, and isn't it a shame we've forgotten that message, or it's never taught in school? Well, of course, we have our pamphlet we mentioned earlier. We Are a Republic, little pamphlet, but it's got all the information you need to know the difference between a republic and a democracy. And then, of course, we carry a book by our good friend John Stormer, Betrayed by the Bench, going into the background of the Supreme Court and the terrible things they've done in destroying the foundation of our society. And nine people rule America, the judges. The nine Supreme Court justices have taken unto themselves power that they were never supposed to have. But, of course, then you have to understand what energizes them, and that's why my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, is so important, because it will tell you not only why these Supreme Court justices took God and prayer out of school, but what was their motivation? Well, we tell you their motivation. It's because, of course, they worship a different God. And, of course, at the time that they took the God and prayer out of our schools, the Masons controlled the United States Supreme Court, and majorities of 5-4 to 8-10 for a 30-year period between 1941 and 1971. And it's interesting that the government's putting on a program now talking about the emblem on the back of the dollar bill and assuring everybody it has nothing to do with Freemasonry. And that's a blatant lie, because I read the Masonic literature, and they will tell you, the Masons will tell you, the emblem, the pyramid cap on the all-seeing eye, is Masonic. Well, that's a half-truth. It is an ancient emblem going back to the ancient mystery religions, but certainly the modern-day Masonry is a modern-day manifestation of the ancient mystery religions. And, of course, you need to know what the ancient mystery religions were all about. I don't think most Masons are well enough read to understand, but modern-day Masonry is simply a brand of Gnosticism, a rebirth of Gnosticism in America, as is the New Age movement, as is Rosicrucianism, as Theosophy, as are so many of these secret societies that exist in our society today. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, there are secret societies. And, of course, if you one of them would be Skull and Bones. Our president is a member. The man who ran against him in the year 2004, John Kerry, happened to come from the same secret society. How could it be that in a nation of 300 million, we could not find a candidate who was not a member of the same secret society to run against George Bush in the year 2004? Or maybe it's all a facade. And it really is. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get my talk on the forbidden secret. Now, if you'd like to know about these items, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You need to understand the forbidden secret, because it, of course, is the key to understanding why the Supreme Court justices took God out of our schools and prayer out of our schools. And it's a key to understanding why we go from war to war to war. It's a key to understanding why our whole economy is collapsing today, why we have become an immoral country, why the church is changing, why, you know, even in many of our churches today, we don't sing the same old songs or hymns, and we don't preach the traditional gospel that we're all sinners saved by grace. We've sort of put that to one side, but why have these things happened? Well, you need to understand the forbidden secret, and, of course, how it permeates every aspect of life in America and throughout the world today. Again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And we'll be back in just a couple of moments here with the next hour. Remember, you can always hear us on the Internet at radioliberty.com. Hail, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the program of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests. And for the next hour, we're going to have with us Arthur Bernclough for Veterans for Constitutional Law. And of course, we're going to be talking about the plight of the American war veterans, certainly the plight of the veterans of the Vietnam War and the plight of the veterans of the First Gulf War and now of the Second Gulf War. Of course, they've experimented on our veterans. This is why so many of them are ill after the First Gulf War and why almost 80,000 of the 695,000 men we sent there are dead. And if you doubt that, we have the pages from the Veterans Administration webpage where they actually talk about the fact that, and I think that as the figures are, they say, well, those still living are, and when they can subtract that from the 695,000, it's almost 80,000 are dead. How could that happen? These were healthy young men when they went overseas. Only 100 died in battle, and why are the rest of them dying off, so many of them? Well, nobody wants to talk about that. Nobody wants to talk about why, within 3 months of our young men returning home from the current wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, almost 30% of them are ill. There are hundreds of thousands of them who are on disability, and hundreds of thousands still trying to get a disability, and they can't seem to find the time in the Veterans Administration to hear their cases, or if they do hear their cases, they find some reason to turn them down. And on the front lines of the battle to defend the veterans is Arthur Bernclough, and I give him a lot of credit. He doesn't get paid for what he's doing, but he's a veteran himself, and he's trying to help the veterans, and they have an organization that is not on the payroll of the government, like the Veterans of Foreign Wars, or the Disabled American Veterans, or the American Legion, or all of these other organizations that are all taking grants from the government in one form or another and are not representing the veterans the way they should. And as a result, the veteran gets trapped into this administrative law system, and many times, of course, he becomes impoverished and despondent, and sometimes he even takes his own life because it seems like the country that he fought and bled and suffered and died for has turned against him. Well, the truth of the matter is, our government has been taken over by wicked people who have no concern about the veterans, and they talk about them, and they pretend to be concerned, but they're really not concerned at all. They're trying to limit the amount of money that's put out for the veterans, and then they find new wars for them to go off and fight. Well, Arthur, tell us what's going on as far as the veterans are concerned, and do you want to tell us about your recent legal encounter?
Oh, yes, yeah. Let me get into that briefly before I get into the other stuff that I have for you, Dr. Stan.
Well, you've sort of been targeted by the government. They want to make your life miserable. And when they target you, they'll find anything that they can to harass you. And Arthur, because he stood up for the veterans, has come under a pattern of harassment. So what's happened?
Well, for many years, my telephone has been tapped for the last 8 years. I've got a tap on my telephone. I've gone into court 4 times, and I've had the tap removed in federal court. And within a few weeks, the tap is back on my phone.
You see, the people in government really don't care about the law.
Not at all.
They have an agenda, and they want, of course, to make Arthur's life as miserable as they can. And maybe when you hear what he talks about this evening, you'll understand why. So go ahead with the story.
Well, I asked for a permanent injunction against the Justice Department to remove that tap once and for all, and they came back with the decision, we don't give permanent injunctions against the Justice Department. So I always refer to the Justice Department as just us. And the latest harassment was I've received 4 visits here at home from alcohol, tobacco, and firearms.
All right, hold on. We'll be back in just a moment with Arthur Bernclough as he tells this incredible story. Go ahead, Arthur.
Okay, I've received 4 visits here from alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, with warrants to search on premises for weapons. And the first three times, no problem. I let him in. I let him search. I brought down. I have some firearms here that I keep for protection. I have permits for everything. And I brought my firearms down. I let them check it. They went through my permits and everything. They found everything in order. And the fourth time they came was on a Sunday morning at 6 o'clock. And
now, why would they come at Sunday morning at 6 o'clock? When, of course, most people are sleeping at the time. And why Sunday, the Lord's Day?
It's a harassment. It's a pure harassment. I saw four of them standing on my doorstep, and they said, we're here, and we have a warrant to search for firearms. I said, fine. I'll be glad to let you in as soon as I confirm the warrant with the court, like I did the other three times. And they said, the court is closed. It's Sunday. And I said, then you'll have to come back tomorrow. And they said, we're coming in now. And I said, not unless you shoot your way in. And they looked at me, I looked at them, and they said, all right, wise guy, we'll see you in the morning first thing. And knowing the antagonism between them and myself, because in my opinion, these people are little more, if not exactly the same, as Adolf Hitler's stormtroopers.
Oh, they're simply doing what they're told to do.
They're getting paid to do what they're doing, and I suppose they do it well. But they're walking down my driveway toward their truck. It's still dark out. And I called out to them. I said, please, stay in the driveway. Watch your step. Don't step off the driveway. I have four Claymore mines buried out in the front of the house, which, of course, you know I don't. And they said, we'll see you tomorrow morning, wise ass. And that was 7 weeks ago. They never came back. What it was is I asked to take a look at their warrant anyway, and they didn't show it to me. When I knew they weren't coming in, they wouldn't show me the warrant. I wanted to take a photostatic copy and check with the court tomorrow morning, the next morning. Anyhow, I decided a couple of weeks ago to bring suit against these people for the harassment. And I was going to go.
Did you have their names, or did you just name the BAP?
Oh yes, I had their names. They two of them were here before, so I had the names of the people. And I decided to bring suit against them. And I went to a local court here, and I was going to go on my own. I wasn't going to hire a lawyer, but our organization says you're not going into court alone, Burnclaw, because. They'll say something, you'll say something.
Hold on, we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course Arthur, because he's been championing the rights of the lawyer, of the veterans, he's been targeted by the government for a pattern of harassment. And so, what, they've actually been to his home four times in the past for the BATF to check his weapons. Each time they had a warrant, each time he showed them the weapons, each time there was nothing wrong. But recently, about 7 weeks ago, they arrived at 6 o'clock on Sunday morning.
Oh, yeah.
Sunday morning, and they demanded to come in the house, and he asked to see their warrant, and of course they wouldn't show it to them, but he said he wanted to check with the court. They said the court's not open till tomorrow, and they said, fine, you come back tomorrow with a warrant, and we'll let you go ahead and we'll check it. If it's a legitimate warrant, we'll let you in. And of course they left angrily.
Very angry.
And of course threatening to be back the next morning, but they didn't come back the next morning. So Arthur,
in 7 weeks,
trying to put this to rest once and for all, sued them and took them to court. He had the names of several of these BATF agents. And you have to understand, these are just government employees. They're doing what they're told to do, harassing anybody who they're told to harass, and it is a pattern of harassment. It's whether I've had people, lots of our friends have been visited by the black helicopters, and they hover over the top of the house or come down right to level with the windows and
they're
on a hillside so that they can intimidate people. They tap the telephones, as Arthur's telephone has been tapped. But, Arthur, what happened when you went to court there? And you actually
Let me get back to the first visit we had here. I may have precipitated this a little bit. It may not be a personal thing, but it's a harassment, being that the work that I do is to help veterans in this country. And the last thing in the world the government wants to do is help the veterans of this country. Anyway, the first time they looked at the weapons, they found everything in order. And I said, what are you people actually looking for? First I asked them, who sent you? And they said, we don't have to reveal our sources. I said, okay, that's understandable. And I said, what are you actually looking for? And they said, lethal automatic weapons. So I may have precipitated something. I yelled upstairs, Hans, where have you hidden the Schmeisers? And they went ballistic when they heard that. So a Schmeisser is a German machine pistol from World War II. Anyway, I went to court, and I had intended to go in myself without an attorney, but the people who I work with at Veterans for Constitutional Law said, you're not going into court without an attorney, because they'll say something, you'll say something, and it's going to result in a riot that's not going to do any of us any good. So they got an attorney for me, we went in, I testified, and one of their people testified, and I was fortunate. I had a good judge. And the judge said, this is a pure harassment to come in on Sunday morning at 6 o'clock. This is a pure harassment to do this, and this is not going to take place in my court. And they said to the people from ATF, they said, if you come back again to search, even with a warrant, you'd better have a policeman from the town here or from the county accompanying you. You cannot come in the man's property at all, and they told me, tack up a sign on your property, a no trespassing sign. So, which I did. So, if they come, they better have a local policeman or a county policeman, otherwise they're breaking the law, and I'll take them to court again.
And I think people have to understand that, of course, there are laws. The federal government has no authority in your community. Absolutely none. Unless,
right,
of course, the local sheriff's office or police force agrees to allow them to come in. They cannot come in on their own.
Exactly.
Of course, they will try to intimidate you, try to threaten you. But, of course, these are the tactics that are always used by tyrants. And, unfortunately, we got a lot of people. They got a good job. They got a pension. They've got their health insurance. They don't want to lose their job. And so they go right along, even if they know what they're doing is morally wrong and illegal, as long as they can get away with it. And Arthur's got an awful lot of intestinal fortitude to stand up against them. But he's doing that all the time as he's trying to get justice for the veterans. And there is an organized effort by very powerful people to deprive veterans of their constitutional rights, and certainly what they've been promised by the military and by the Veterans Administration.
Yep.
So tell us what's happening as far as our veterans is concerned, because so many of them really are having real problems. Incidentally, if any of our listeners would like those pages from the Veterans Administration webpage that we have that talk about almost 80,000 of the veterans who were fought in the first Gulf War 18 years ago, 17 years ago, are no longer living. We'll be glad to send those to you free of charge. Could this really be true? Why isn't Rush Limbaugh telling us? Why isn't Sean Hannity telling us? Why isn't the New York Times telling us?
Because they're in the pocket of the government.
Right, absolutely. The finest finest talk show host that money could buy. Go right ahead.
Okay. Before I get off this subject with the court, the judge really dressed down that Justice Department attorney there. The judge really slammed him. He let him have it. And I spoke to the judge afterwards, and he said, I wouldn't worry much about this. He says, for some reason, I don't think you're going to hear from them again. He says, I don't think they want to take you on. Very few people will take them into court. I happen to be somebody that will take anyone into court if they give me a sufficient reason, and I think a Sunday morning, 6 o'clock in the morning harassment is a sufficient reason. And that's why I took them into court, so it doesn't happen again.
Well, they took them to a small claims court. How did you actually get them into court?
Well, it wasn't small claims, it was a county court.
All right.
I took them into court on a harassment charge that they harassed me by coming to my door and trying to force their way into my home at 6 o'clock in the morning on Sunday.
All right. Well, of course, they usually like to come in the middle of the night. You know, this is a standard thing. It instills fear in people's heart. It's the technique that was used in communist Russia, Nazi Germany, and it's very often used right here in America. And people say, that couldn't happen.
Oh, there's been a lot of cases where they've broken down the doors.
Right.
Someone didn't want to let them in. They've broken down the doors.
Go right ahead.
But anyway, I've got some good, encouraging news from San Francisco. The lawsuit involving over 800,000 veterans against the VA and former Attorney General Gonzalez has gone forward. The trial has started now, and the judge who is going to be in charge is Judge Samuel Conte, a conservative jurist and a World War II veteran. And veterans advocates can now proceed with the lawsuit, and they're also claiming that the federal government's health care system for troops returning from Afghanistan and Iraq illegally denies care and benefits.
All right, now, basically, is this the basis of the suit? Is it because the VA medical system isn't working? Is it that they are depriving the veterans of their adequate hearings so they can get disability benefits?
Both.
What is the basis of it? It's both issues?
The basis of the suit is two things. They're being denied the health care, and they're being denied disability benefits.
All right, fine.
Those are the two bases of the suit. And Judge Conte, he rejected the Bush administration arguments that civil courts have no authority over the Department of Veterans Affairs medical decisions or how it handles grievances and claims. And he said, if the plaintiffs can prove their allegations, Conte said, they would show that thousands and thousands of veterans, if not more, are suffering grievous injuries as a result of their inability to procure desperately needed and obviously deserved health care. Their health care is being withheld from these veterans. And he said that federal courts are competent to decide whether those injuries were caused by flaws in the health care system and the VA's grievance procedures. Now, Conte did not rule on the adequacy of the treatment system, which will be addressed in the future proceedings, but he decided one disputed issue right away, finding that the veterans are legally entitled to 2 years of health care after leaving the service. The government had argued that it was required to provide only as much care as the VA's budget allowed in a given year. This is how they're trying to get around things. And a lawyer for the plaintiffs, Melissa Krasnitz of Disability Rights Associates, said the judge had rejected the VA's shameful effort to keep those deserving veterans from their day in court. They try to get the case thrown out of court, like they always do, the Justice Department. Now, the next step is a hearing on the plaintiff's request for an injunction that would require the federal agency to provide immediate mental health treatment for veterans who suffer from stress disorders and are at risk of suicide. Said Stanley Walensky. He's another disability rights associate lawyer. And the hearing is scheduled this week, February 22nd. It may be called off to March 3rd. They may have to postpone that to March 3rd for more witnesses. The suit claims that the federal government's failure to provide timely treatment is contributing to an epidemic of suicide among returning soldiers. Now, the suit was filed in July by two veterans organizations, Veterans for Common Sense and Veterans United for Truth, as a proposed class action on behalf of up to 800,000 veterans, but it's gonna surpass that 800,000 veterans, or their survivors. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned their survivors. The group said the VA arbitrarily denies care and benefits to wounded veterans, forces them to wait months for treatment and years for benefits, gives them little recourse when it rejects their medical claims. The department has a backlog of more than 770 disability claims, the suit says.
770,000.
I'm sorry, 770,000
Disability claims that they haven't got around to. Oh, we're just so busy, and we've got to give all of our money to Halliburton, Dick Cheney's old company, and ladies and gentlemen, they're wasting money, and they're not putting it in on the veterans.
They got plenty of money for Halliburton, though.
They sure do, and for for building a cellar there at Dick Cheney's house, a place he can go in case there's a nuclear attack. They spent millions of dollars making a shelter for Dick Cheney and his family, but there's just no money for the veterans. We'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Go right ahead.
Now, the Pentagon Study Group reported in June, that's June of this year, that the system was understaffed, prompting the VA to announce staffing increases in July. That's when the trial started. Actually, the trial was announced in July, and the trial is just starting now. The study group also found, as you had mentioned before, that 84,000 veterans, more than one-third of those who sought care from the department from 2002 through 2006, had been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress or another mental disorder. In seeking dismissal of the suit, the Justice Department argued that Congress had barred federal courts from hearing complaints about the VA system when it established a special court of appeals for veterans' claims in 1988 to review grievances over treatment and benefits. Now, let me tell you a little bit about that court established in 1988. They've had over 18,000 cases go before that court, and we have a grand total of 196 veteran wins out of the 18,000 cases, so you know what kind of a court it is. Now, Judge Conte said the special court can examine only individual cases and has no power to consider systematic constitutional challenges. He says those belong in regular federal courts. Conte also said the VA system originally intended as an informal procedure to help veterans resolve their claims has morphed into an adversarial process in which claimants have to comply with formal legal rules, often, very often, without a lawyer. And it's written within the court's power to insist that veterans be granted a level of due process that is commensurate with the adjudication procedures with which they are confronted, Judge Conte said. And, of course, efforts to reach the Justice Department were unsuccessful. And my thanks to Bob Angelko from the San Francisco Chronicle, staff writer, a reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle, for this information. Now, going into a little detail about this, veterans are not entitled to mental health care, United States lawyers say. And this comes from fellow they call VA Watchdog, but it was written up here again by Bob Angelko, the San Francisco Chronicle staff writer. Veterans have no legal right to specific types of medical care, the Bush administration argues in a lawsuit, accusing the government of illegally denying mental health treatment to some troops returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. This has been the government's argument on VA health care for some time, and it's not what the veteran needs, it's what we say you'll get if we have the money to give it to you.
But of course, don't they have thousands of lawyers there that work for the Veterans Administration to deprive the veterans of their what is due to them?
12,000 of them, and until recently, a veteran was not allowed to have his own attorney.
So they got 12,000 attorneys. The veteran can't have his attorney, and this is how the legal system works. Well,
exactly, but since they passed the new law, Senate Bill S-3421, a veteran is now entitled to hire an attorney to fight his claim.
And, of course, they did everything to block that. They did not want the veteran to be able to get a fair hearing in court. They had 12,000 attorneys. The veteran couldn't have one, and... But fortunately, who got that legislation through?
We were one of the main driving forces that got that legislation through.
Okay, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. And, Chris, what you must understand is the way the Veterans Administration system worked. For many years, and we're talking about decades, they had a system where a veteran could not bring a lawyer into the hearings, but the federal government, the Veterans Administration, had 12,000 lawyers they were paying fantastic salaries to deprive the veterans of their right to medical and disability care and disability payments. So only recently have they actually got a law through so that the veteran can have legal representation. Everything was done to fight that. The last thing they want is for the veteran to get a fair shake, and they have over 700,000 cases of veterans trying to get disability payments, and they just can't get around to hearing them. Or go right ahead, Arthur.
Okay, now, According to this, they say veterans, the government says veterans have no legal right to specific types of medical care. The Bush administration argues in a lawsuit that accuses the government of illegally denying mental health treatment to some troops returning from the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And the arguments that were filed in federal court in San Francisco, they strike at the heart of a lawsuit filed on behalf of veterans that claims the health care system for returning troops provides little recourse when the government rejects their medical claims. The VA is making progress in increasing its staffing and screening veterans for combat-related stress, Justice Department lawyers say. But their central argument is that Congress left decisions about who should get health care and what type of care to the VA and not to the veterans or the courts. The VA wishes, but now they're going to face the moment of truth, a real court. And I'll tell you right now, I think they're going to decimate the VA. Federal law providing 5 years of care for veterans from the date of their discharge establishes veterans' eligibility for health care, but it does not create an entitlement to any particular medical service, government lawyers say. They say the law entitles veterans only to medical care which the secretary of the VA determines is needed, and only to the extent funds available. The argument drew a sharp retort from a lawyer for advocacy groups that sued the government in July. The suit is a proposed class action on behalf of up to 800,000 veterans or their survivors. Veterans need to know in this country that the government thinks all their benefits are mere gratuities. Gifts. Gordon Erspammer, who is the main attorney for the veterans group, said, they're saying it's completely discretionary, that even if Congress appropriates money for veterans' health care, we can do anything we want with the money. That's what the VA says. Even if Congress appropriates it, they can do anything they want with it. And this has got to come to a stop. My original suggestion is have the Government Accountability Office take over the running of the VA, fire all those bureaucrats and executives, and run things the right way.
Maybe get rid of those 11,000 lawyers that they've
got. Yeah. The issue will be joined March 7th at a hearing before U.S. District Judge Samuel Conte, who denied the administration's request last month to dismiss the suit. While the case is pending, the plaintiffs want Conte to order the government to provide immediate mental health treatment for veterans who say they are thinking of killing themselves, and to spend another $60 million on health care, at the very least. The suit accuses the VA of arbitrarily denying care and benefits to wounded veterans, of forcing them to wait months and months for treatment and years for benefits, and of failing to provide fair procedures for appealing decisions against them. And the plaintiffs say that the department has a backlog of 770,000 disability claims, and that 120 veterans a week commit suicide. Now, that 770,000 figure is being examined again closely, and we think it's going to be increased to about, I'd say, around 840 to 850,000.
And I think what's really so important to realize is, of course, a lot of these veterans are contemplating suicide. They're probably going to put them on Prozac, and one of the complications of Prozac is people get both homicidal and suicidal thoughts. And so, you know, they're already considering suicide, and then they're going to put them on a drug that there's a black box now on the insert that says, you know, this can bring about suicide. What sort of madness is this?
They got plenty of Prozac, believe me.
Plenty of Prozac. It's made a lot of money for the drug companies. It's a very ineffective drug in many, many ways. And, of course, if you go back and you look at the original studies on it, of course, there was really not that much of a benefit from it.
Nope.
It was just almost as well. It was a little bit better than placebo, but not that much better.
Well, in the judge's January 10th ruling, it allowed the suit to proceed, and Conte said federal law entitles veterans to health care for a specific period after leaving the service, rejecting the government's argument that it was required to provide only as much care as the VA budget allowed in a given year.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Arthur, go ahead and pick up the story.
Okay, a law that President Bush signed last week extended the period from 2 to 5 years. In its latest filing, however, the Justice Department reiterated that Congress had intended to authorize but not require medical care for veterans. They're playing games with words, Dr.
In other words, they authorize but they don't require, so they won't give it. It's only authorized but not required. And I mean, how do you come up with this sort of, constructive...
This is the government's double talk.
Right.
This is exactly what... The court should not interfere with the political branch's design, oversight, and modification of VA programs, the government lawyers argued. They also said the VA is making great progress in addressing the mental health care needs of combat veterans. I haven't seen it. If they are, I haven't seen it at all. Among other things, they cited a law passed in November that required the department to establish a suicide prevention program that includes making mental health care available around the clock. And that hasn't happened. Believe me, it hasn't happened. The VA has hired nearly 3,800 mental health professionals in the last 2 years and has at least one specialist in post-traumatic stress disorder at each of its medical centers. This is what the government says. Now, since June, government lawyers said the VA has had a policy that all veterans who seek or are referred for mental health care should be screened within 24 hours, that those found to be at risk of suicide should be treated immediately, and that others should be scheduled for full diagnosis and treatment planning within 2 weeks. A new suicide prevention hotline has been responsible for more than 380 rescues, the lawyers say.
But is there any truth to what the lawyers said? Because lawyers lie.
Of course.
Of course, if they lie in court, nothing's ever done to a lawyer. If he's working for the government and he lies to the judges?
Well, the plaintiff's lawyer, Gordon Erspammer, said he was unimpressed with all this talk from the VA. And what he says is, nowhere do I see any explanation of what kind of systems they have in place that deal with suicidal veterans. He said there's no excuse for not spending the money Congress told them to spend on mental health care and leaving $60 million on the table when people are going out and killing themselves. And this is the VA that we all know and love. And I'd like to talk about a certain case here that came across my desk last week. Sergeant Stanford Mendenhall. He's a member of the United States Army's famous Fighting 69th Battalion, who's marooned at home with a variety of serious illnesses while he's struggling to stay alive. But for this soldier,
Arthur, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought.
Sure.
We'll get back to Sergeant Mendenhall in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Arthur Bernkow from Veterans for Constitutional Law. Arthur, before we go on, I want you to get out your website. I want to get out your telephone number, because there are veterans out all across America listening to this program who've been in the Veterans Administration program and totally frustrated. They can't get medical care. They can't get, of course, the disability payments. Over 700,000 veterans are waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting to get their disability payments, and they're being put off. Why? Why? Because, of course, the government wants to use the money for other purposes, and they really don't care about the veterans. There's something... Well, they're not any use to our society today, and so they've already fought and bled and suffered and died, but
exactly.
Those that survived, really, how are we going to deprive them of care? And that is the way what's really going on in the Veterans Administration. Now, why don't you get your telephone number out, get out your website.
Okay. Right? You know, solution is we've got to bring an end to the VA as it exists now, and it's got to be taken over by the Government Accountability Office and people who show some kind of responsibility. Anyway, I'm Arthur Bernkow. I'm the Executive Director of Veterans for Constitutional Law, and we help veterans win their claims with the VA. And I'm at your service. Anytime you need me, you can always contact me at this number. I'm at 631-474-4261. We don't charge you for our services at all, and we try to help you win your case. And if you want to write us, we're Veterans for Constitutional Law Limited. LTD is okay. Veterans for Constitutional Law Limited. And we're located at number 112, 112 Jefferson Avenue in Port Jefferson, New York. And our zip code is 11777. So that's Veterans for Constitutional Law Limited, 112 Jefferson Avenue, Port Jefferson, New York, 11777. And I have to specify, we don't find lawyers for you. So people who keep calling up saying, get me a lawyer, we don't do that. We don't recommend any lawyers in particular, but what we will do as a free service to you is if you think you have a lawyer who might do you some good on the case, we'll talk to that lawyer and we'll evaluate him for you at no charge. And we'll let you know whether or not the man is going to do good for your case or whether to keep looking.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, of course, Arthur was telling us about a sergeant. Was it Stanford Mendenhall? Who's that?
Yes, Sergeant Stanford Mendenhall.
All right, go ahead and tell the story.
And the soldier, the mother of all battles, is taking place stateside, not in the distant sands of Iraq where powerful sandstorms blow all around all manner of filth and toxins, as Mendenhall experienced directly. The Suffolk County, New York soldier understands that a number of other members of his battalion are a lot like him, once supremely healthy, only to serve in Iraq and come home physically and psychologically shattered from innumerable illnesses that are both hard to explain and virtually impossible to treat.
Just for a moment, for our listeners, we're exposing our people over there to depleted uranium. It's a terrible toxin. We're contaminating the whole area. It's in shells, the mortar shells. If you have any question about that, we have a wonderful DVD with comes with a CD-ROM. That will give you thousands of pages of government documents on how toxic this is, even though the government insists it isn't. These are government documents. The DVD, Beyond Treason, it's the story of depleted uranium and how we're poisoning our own soldiers. But why should we be surprised at that? We've poisoned our soldiers. We've used them for experiments. And if you haven't seen the Rockefeller Committee report that we have here, came out of the Veterans Administration in 1994, you need to get it. You need to understand that they experiment with our soldiers. They play little games with their lives and their futures. Well, but anyway, so many of these young men are coming back. They're ill from depleted uranium, perhaps other experiments. We don't know what they're doing. And believe me, it's all top secret. We couldn't let that information get out. But pick up the story there, Arthur.
Okay, well, I'd like to urge everybody who's listening who is concerned with Veterans Affairs to purchase this DVD from you, Dr. Stan, because it's going to help them understand what is really going on. So I would really like to urge everybody listening in to just make note of that, because this is something that will give you a better understanding of what the veterans' problem here is in America. Now, Mendenhall and his wife, Linda, they strongly suspect that a significant cause is the depleted uranium exposure in the Iraq War. The same culprit is suspected in the cancer deaths of young soldiers in their 20s, as reported by AFP last year. Almost at a total loss on what to do to help her husband, given the apparent unwillingness of the allegedly hostile military chain of command to help him, Linda explained their plight to American Free Press newspaper. He can't work. She's working full-time. Money is scarce, and aside from sundry exams and some back surgery, the soldier claimed he has gone more than 2 years without proper medical care since leaving the battle theater. Mendenhall, who is now 45 years old, having left Iraq in 2005 after just 1 year, has a number of vexing health problems. He said his problems start with a persistent and severe back and chest pain, and he now has chronic lung granuloma, sometimes that's linked to TB, along with pulmonary hypertension, osteoporosis, low testosterone, and a metabolic bone disease that befuddled doctors even at the Mayo Clinic. Blacks such as Mendenhall rarely get osteoporosis, he said, and it does not run in his family. His wife says he started out with the less severe osteopenia, but that it remarkably became full-blown osteoporosis in about 1 year from 2006 to 2007. The Mayo doctors felt they could not treat Mendenhall and advised he get medical treatment from the VA or a specialized military hospital such as Walter Reed. Depleted uranium, or DU, first was widely used as a weapons component by U.S. forces in the first Gulf War. It's an ultra-dense metallic substance that's used defensively in armor and is extensively used as a super-hard penetrating agent on the tip of explosive rounds to easily demolish armored vehicles and other hardened targets. Its detonation by U.S. forces, however, exposes combatants on both sides as well as civilians to radioactive fragments and aerosols, among other types of toxic fallout. It is dangerous and must be handled according to strict guidelines. When widely used, it can contaminate soil and water, can be ingested by unprotected troops and other people via the skin, through the lungs, open wounds, etc. Other health hazards for soldiers cannot be written off. They include experimental vaccines, insecticides, disease-bearing pests, etc. Linda recalled how healthy her husband was all his life until he served in Iraq in the infantry. She remembers him dashing out the door in the morning to work as a letter carrier. He did heavy lifting all the time. He was one of these people who never even needed an aspirin, she said. Today, however, Mendenhall, who served in the Army a total of 22 years, but has not been discharged, can hardly lift a thing. A tumor developed on a fracture on his back. He and his wife must also struggle with a military establishment whose chain of command makes him attend medical evaluation board meetings that assess his status for possible disability payment authorization down the road, but they have not given him a line of duty status that could get him on an express lane to a proper military medical facility. He's not being treated, this man. And then there's the polite brush-off that the Mendenhalls have repeatedly received from Senator Hillary Clinton, Democrat in New York, when the former First Lady's legislative office was asked to help Mendenhall get the right treatment, and much the same from Senator Charles Schumer, another Democrat in New York. Apparent concern expressed in return calls amid claims legislators cannot tell the military what to do. That's the answer they get from these legislators. Now, the Mendenhalls have approached several private hospitals, but were told the treatment must be obtained at military facilities, being that he is still a serviceman. The runaround never seems to stop. Linda said she has placed 600 telephone calls to Joseph J. Peluto, the Adjutant General of the New York Army National Guard in Albany. The purpose was to inquire about transportation, medical referral to Walter Reed, and incapacitation pay issues. She said she sent Peluto 50 certified letters. What a disgrace. But Peluto, whose position puts him just under the governor in charge of New York National Guard units, allegedly never responded. Other military bureaucrats are said to have intervened to cancel appointments. They told us that a whole battalion was contaminated with DU, Linda said, referring to a family readiness group meeting routinely assembled for all deployed battalions to meet with spouses and parents of soldiers. Linda said her husband, with whom she's had 4 children, at times seemed like he could pass away, but they don't know what else to do other than keep fighting. And this is no longer the so-called war on terror, which sparked the 9/11 attacks. Instead, the war is here, against the very establishment for which the soldiers enlisted to fight. This is a sad thing, Dr. Stan. And I might inject a little levity into this. This tourist was in San Francisco, and he went into a curio shop. And he saw something he liked. He saw a life-size statue of a bronze rat. And he says, I'd like that. How much is it? And the man said, $12 and $100 for the story. And he says, skip the story. I'll take the rat. So he left holding the bronze rat, and he's walking down the street. And he hears noise behind him. And rats are coming out of the sewer and out of the alley, and they're following him down the street. And they're increasing their speed, and he starts walking faster. About a block down, he looks behind him, and he sees hundreds of rats following him. And he really started running, going toward the bay, and looks back over his shoulder again, and there's thousands of rats following him. He gets down to the pier, he goes to the end of the pier, and he takes the rat, the bronze rat, and throws it as far as he can into the water. And all the rats jump into water after it, and they drown. Goes back to the curio shop, and the owner of the curio shop says to him, oh, you're back for the story. He says, no, I'm not back for the story, but do you have any other statues, maybe of a banker or a politician or any other elected official? I'd like to buy it.
Shame on you.
You know.
All right, fine. Well, that was Arthur Burton Clough, and that's anyway. Of course, we have real problems as far as the veterans are concerned, and Arthur's on the front lines of this battle to try to get the treatment for them. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, because we really need, of course, to get the information to the American people, and this is what we're doing. But if you have a problem out there, you're one of those veterans who hasn't been able to get adequate care, the number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. And certainly, do you think that the veterans are going to be successful in this lawsuit that's being brought in San Francisco? What's the outlook for it, and when is it going to be continuing?
The outlook is very good. I believe it's continuing on March 7th.
All right, fine.
It will be continuing on March 7th. I think there's going to be some kind of a hearing on the in a few more days. I think the 27th or something. There's going to be a hearing, but it'll continue fully on March 7th.
All right, fine. Well, we've got a caller here, and it looks like we've got Bruce calling. And where's Bruce calling from? Bruce is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Bruce. How are you doing?
How are you doing, Dr. Stan? I'm doing fine.
Are you listening to us on shortwave or the Internet?
I'm listening on the Internet.
Well,
I don't get the second hour here unless I listen on the Internet.
Well, we're glad you do. Anyway, do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do. No matter how bad Arthur says it is, it's a lot worse.
Well, you obviously have had some dealings with the Veterans Administration.
Oh, I absolutely have. I've been
denied. Spokane, Washington is one of the hot spots in this country for Veterans Affairs.
Well,
I know it well.
Pardon?
Spokane, Washington is one of the hot spots for Veterans Affairs. They've got a lot of trouble in that hospital over there.
I'm used to not being treated well, but that apparently, to me, they treat me fairly well, even though they ignore a few things. But it's not the hospital that I have my problems with, it's the administration.
Oh, yeah.
And,
that's
of course, going back, it is the National Guard, the same as that other person, where I, 24 years and no retirement, made a congressional complaint, and they basically held me out and did everything they could to destroy me. And it was based on medical treatment or lack thereof.
Oh, I believe you.
And, well, I had my... fifth denial for my benefits, I think it is. And I did get to see the QualMed that you talked about, I think, on the last time, and that was a joke beyond belief.
Well, maybe if I could make a suggestion, Bruce, why don't you call Arthur off the air and talk to him? He can probably give you a lot of suggestions because that's what he does. He knows how to work the system.
Oh, I sure can. I think I can probably help you. Now, you have my telephone number, Bruce?
Absolutely.
Okay, now I'm available day
and night.
I can always
find you. Like you're on the Internet. I can find you.
I'm available day and night. Your best. I'm on the Internet. It's Burnclough at OPT online.net.
Yes, I can find you.
Okay,
but you're better off.
If you've got an opportunity for somebody else to talk to Arthur, then go ahead. I'll get hold of Arthur.
Okay, you're better off calling me on my telephone line, and believe me, I will respond to your call. If I'm
not
there, leave word, and I will respond to it.
Okay, thanks.
God bless you, Bruce. Bye-bye. And, of course, Bruce is simply one of the millions of our veterans out there who are having difficulty with the Veterans Administration because, of course, the whole idea is not to provide health care, not to provide benefits. It's to deprive them as much as you can, get away with anything you can. And unfortunately, we do not have honorable men in government, but why should we be taking God out of our government? We've taken God out of our schools. We've removed morality from this country, and I fear that God is going to bring his judgment in the not-too-distant future. Well, anyway, Arthur, we've got about a minute and a half before we go to the last break of the program. So what message do you want to leave for our listeners?
Okay. First of all, I've got something here from a Hawaiian gentleman. I don't know if you're familiar with this man. His name is Poka Luani.
No, I really don't know Poka Luani, but go ahead.
Okay. It's he's written this piece, which came on my desk about 2 days ago. It's a 7-step plan to end terrorism, it's an honorable exit from Iraq. And this Hawaiian really makes sense. And the United States should not win in its war against Iraq. It should change its strategy to being just. The United States was wrong to attack Iraq. Possession of weapons of mass destruction is not a justification. Moreover, Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction. Toppling Saddam Hussein is no justification. The imposition by a stronger nation of its political preference for the running of another nation's government has never been a legitimate basis for attack.
I agree with you, and I think it's so vitally important that the American people understand that we are responsible for what our administration has done. There are over 100,000 Iraqis dead. And, of course, the justification is we got poor intelligence, we didn't know what we were doing. Well, who got fired? Well, I think we ought to fire somebody, don't you?
I think we ought to fire a whole bunch of them.
All right, go right ahead. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Okay, every justification for the attack by the United States against Iraq leads to the same conclusion. The United States acted as an international delinquent, a violator of Iraqi sovereignty, and an international threat to peace. So how could one even entertain the notion of winning a war for which there's no justification? The thinking among the leadership of American society in trying to find a victorious exit from Iraq is awry. The United States has been the bad guy all along, and it must now exit honorably. The elements of an honorable exit strategy should include the following. Number one, confession. Declare to the Iraqi people and the international community that the United States was wrong in conducting this war. Number two, apology. Apologize to the Iraqi people and the international community for its conduct of the war. Three, reparation. Take responsibility for the repair of damage caused by the war and bring the people and the physical condition of Iraq back to the condition they would have been in had the United States not invaded Iraq. Iraqi families who suffered the loss of lives or injuries should be compensated in amounts established by a neutral commission and fully funded by the United States. Four, leadership. The United States should leave Iraq immediately and turn over its responsibility for reparation to an international coalition that will direct the rebuilding of Iraq. Five, relinquish profits. The profits gained by U.S. companies and individuals as a result of the war should be turned over to the reparation effort. Six, disengage from Iraqi affairs. The United States should make a legally binding commitment to refrain from any overt or covert attempt to affect the internal affairs of Iraq. Seven, accept accountability. U.S. individuals, including the highest-ranking civilian and military personnel, should be subject to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court and to domestic courts to answer to war crimes charges. The plan will not be supported by the U.S. public initially because of its high price, but the plan will stop the cost from escalating further in terms of life lost and injuries on all sides of the war and the destruction of property. The price will only go higher the longer this unjust war continues, and the repayment will eventually be meted out, if not willingly by the United States, then through continued terrorism throughout the lives of our children and their children ad infinitum. The continuation of this war will not resolve terrorism. If terrorism is to end, it'll only come through a just peace. An end to U.S. government terrorism will decrease other forms of terrorism, and this, along with elements above, can begin to build a foundation of justice as the basis for long-lasting peace.
We're out of time. Good night. Good God bless. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. And, of course, if you want to get into a discussion of the war of Iraq, we'd simply point out that Saddam Hussein was an evil man. He was actually worked for the CIA in the 1950s. We have books written many years ago going into that. We helped to bring him in power in 79. We financed him all during the 1980s. Repeatedly during the 1990s, the Iraqi military tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and each time they made the mistake of contacting the American State Department, the military leaders in Iraq were betrayed, exposed, tortured to death. On not one but two occasions, it's told in the book, See No Evil, which we carry, See No Evil by Robert Byrd, who is a CIA agent working in Iraq in the 1990s. You need to understand that Saddam Hussein was financed by the United States, and we would not allow the Iraqi military to do away with him. Because, you see, there's another agenda out there which most people don't understand. If you want to understand what's really going on in Iraq, let me suggest you go to my website, radioliberty.com, and pull down my December 2007 newsletter. It's simply the speech given by Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez in October of last year. He was the commander of the coalition forces in Iraq for a year, June of 2003, June of 2004. And he will tell you what's going on over there. We're not allowed to win the war. We're not allowed to win the war. Pull down his article, read what he has to say. Then if you want to understand the plight of the veteran, you need to get the Rockefeller Report. It's inexpensive. It was published by the Veterans Administration back in 1994. The woman who published this, I contacted her, and she was afraid to come on our program. I think she fears for her life. We have that DVD we talked about, Beyond Treason. Not only the story of depleted uranium, but a CD-ROM in addition that has thousands of pages of government documents about the danger of depleted uranium, which they're not telling the American people, which they are denying is a problem, and they're simply lying. We have a four-tape set on depleted uranium. We have a four-tape set on the Gulf War illness. We have a four-tape set on anthrax vaccine, which they're giving to our people in the service. And we have a four-tape set on Vaccine A, an experimental vaccine they gave to hundreds of thousands of veterans, hundreds of thousands of our servicemen during the first Gulf War. So that's Vaccine A, anthrax vaccine, Gulf War illness, depleted uranium, all four tape sets. And then, of course, DVD on depleted uranium, Beyond Treason. You need to understand what's going on. You need to understand they use our soldiers as guinea pigs, and that's in the Rockefeller Committee report. It's really a report from the Veterans Administration that came out over the signature of Jay Rockefeller. You need to understand there are people who do not have any human compassion for our military men and, of course, have consistently lied. They lied about Agent Orange, which they knew was toxic, and they exposed our men to over there, and many of them got cancers as a result and all sorts of physical disabilities during the Vietnam War. And, of course, eventually, years later, they admitted that it had all been a lie. Well, if they'd lie about Agent Orange, why wouldn't they lie about depleted uranium? And the thing is, they are lying about depleted uranium, but what's wrong with lying if there are no moral standards? They're teaching our children in school. There's no absolutes. There's no right. There's no wrong. There's no God. And that is the purpose of education today, not to educate, but to indoctrinate and to destroy the faith of our children in God. Because, of course, there is a conspiracy against God. There's a conspiracy against Christianity. And that's why you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's why you need to see my talk. It's available on DVD, The Forbidden Secret. The Forbidden Secret. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Or better still, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because we are at war. We are under attack today by truly wicked forces, wicked spiritual forces, which are energizing many of our leaders. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision and protection, again, our number, 1-800-544-8927.